All right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Philip Drew, Administrator. I'm joined by Brandon Wiley. He is the president of the Foundation for Decentralization Research at decentralized.org.
Hi, thanks.
Tell us, what's the Foundation for the Decentralization Research?
Well, we're a nonprofit corporation, and we do technological research to try to help people, mainly to help the little people be able to do normally what only big corporations can do through technology.
Like, what do you mean that big corporations can do that we can't?
Well, like, the product that we've been developing that we're trying to push right now is called Alluvium, and what it lets you do is do internet audio broadcasting, internet radio, basically, on a shoestring budget. Like, you need, like, an old 486 and just a normal consumer broadband, and then you can broadcast to thousands of people. Whereas right now, a lot of the webcasting, the internet radio stations were shut down a while back because of licensing fees that they came up with, retroactive licensing fees. So all the webcasting stations had to pay licensing fees for all the stuff they were broadcasting back to when they started broadcasting, and so a lot of them went down. And so in order to try to help these people, see, the point of the royalties was to shut down all the small broadcasters so that the only broadcasters that were left were the big ones, who are the same people that own your normal radio stations. And so excuse me. And so we're trying to help the little stations get back, you know, on the internet broadcasting by making it so they could do it for super cheap.
So it was the web companies that started charging the fees, or
no,
it was state intervention?
No, so they passed the law. They passed a federal law that said that you have to pay, if you're doing webcasting, you have to pay royalties to the Recording Industry Association of America. Now, this is even if
what?
You're... What? Yeah, this is even... You have to pay the Recording Industry Association of America even if you aren't broadcasting anything that they own. Even if you're broadcasting entirely independent content, you still have
on
to
the
pay
web.
Royalties. On the web, yeah. Broadcasting on the web.
So and that's a federal law?
That's federal law, yeah. And this is even if you already are paying royalties for broadcasting over the airwaves, you have to pay extra royalties to broadcast over the internet. It's a big mess. And lately the webcasters have been trying to, like, countersue the RIA to get the royalties reduced, but, you know.
I can't imagine under what jurisdiction the national government would have the power to force someone to pay fees to someone else who has nothing to do with it to broadcast their own stuff on an independent website.
Right. Well, what happened is the Recording Industry Association of America is authorized to collect royalties for everyone, not just the people that sign on with them. They're authorized to collect royalties for anyone. So even, you know, like, for instance, you, if you have music, they're authorized to collect royalties and then give them to you. So if people, you know, play your music, then they collect royalties from them and give them to you.
Nice.
Yeah, it's very complicated and confusing.
So then what you guys are developing then is to make it where I can just go ahead and broadcast my stuff on the internet and they can all go to hell.
That's right. They can all go to hell. There's nothing they can do about it. And additionally, it's going to be really cheap. You can just do it out of your house. You don't have to pay for a bunch of web hosting and stuff. And that's our one product that we're pushing right now. But our goal overall is just to help people that are being screwed over by the big corporations and the government, everybody just do their own thing through technology. Because with technology, you can do all kinds of cool stuff for cheap. That's the idea.
Right on. So they invent new technologies to enslave us, and then you find other ways to undercut them and use it back against them.
That's exactly... It's an ongoing war, especially on the internet, because the internet, you know, it wasn't regulated before. You could just kind of do whatever you wanted. And they keep trying to come up with new legislation to regulate what you can do, and then through technology, we can bypass that. Whatever they say, it doesn't matter.
So is this really sort of the same kind of argument as, like, the file sharing MP3s from Napster and WinMX and that sort of thing?
Yeah, well, there's a difference between streaming, broadcasting, and downloading files. It's never been defined what the difference is. Nobody knows what the difference is, but the legislation defines this difference, that if you're broadcasting, you have to pay royalties, and if you're downloading, that's just not allowed at all. There's no... Downloading is totally illegal.
So, Man, I don't know. I'm not very computer literate myself, so I kind of have trouble understanding. On my website, philipdrew.com, you can click on the stream button if you want to stream it, and then it doesn't save it on your computer, right? You're sort of just listening to it off of my website.
Right.
And then if you download it, you're going ahead and saving the
so
MP3.
So that's the thing. Since you have streaming, you are supposed to pay royalties because you have streaming. If you have downloading, then it's not under the jurisdiction of the Recording Industry Association of America unless it's owned by them. But if it's streaming, then you're supposed to pay royalties. But the thing is, they probably won't bother you about it, you know, generally.
Yeah, I wonder, pay royalties to who if this is all, if my website is all my own production? How could anybody, I'm trying to understand. I mean, I know it's the law and it doesn't have to make sense, but under what excuse do I owe Sony Records or something for this conversation we're having right now?
Well, you don't actually owe them any money. You owe money to whoever produced the content, generally, right? So everything you say and everything you write is copyrighted. So, like, for instance, what I'm saying right now is copyrighted by me automatically under the law. Like, my comments are copyrighted, and you can't use them without permission. That's the law. Everything's automatically copyrighted. And so the RIAA is authorized to get money and then give it to whoever the copyright holders are. They don't have to know who it is beforehand. They collect the money, then they figure out who the copyright holders are, and then they give it back. So in your case, I would imagine since you're producing the stuff and it's on your radio show that, you know, probably you'd be the copyright holder. It's confusing whether or not my comments belong to me or since you encode them, they belong to you. I don't really know. It's a very tricky matter.
Well, and really, it's a good point that copyright law, the reason we have copyright law is so exactly that reason. I don't own what you say. You own what you say or produce or a picture you draw or a song that you write. And that's, of course, legitimate that nobody else gets to run around making a bunch of profit off of what you have to say. But then the question, I guess, really what we're debating here, what we're pushing around is the limits and the definitions of fair use. And when is it okay for someone to just go ahead and take a file of this show and give it to whoever they want or sell it to whoever they want, and at what point can they not?
Right. There's the problem with U.S. copyright law is that everything is automatically copyrighted, all rights reserved, whenever you write or say anything. And so there's this organization called the Creative Commons that's really great. And what they do is they produce licenses which say, okay, I don't want all the rights reserved. I want my work to be distributed under certain terms. And so you go to Creative Commons and you can generate a license and you can say, for instance, okay, I want everyone to be able to use this, or I want people to be able to distribute it but not make derivative works, or I want people able to sample it in new works or whatever. And then you put this content on your you put this license on your website, and then people that come to your website know what you want, like what's okay with you. Because right now they just have to assume that without your explicit written permission that they can't do anything, which is really a bad situation.
So I should go ahead and make sure to write at the bottom of my website, no rights reserved. Go ahead.
That's fine, yeah. And there's actually a license you can generate on the Creative Commons website that you can link to from your site so that search engines will know if people are searching for content which is licensed for free use, they'll find you and be like, okay, this site's licensed for free use.
Nice.
Yeah.
Now, I should let the audience know, the guest, again, is Brandon Wiley. He's the president of the Foundation for Decentralization Research. And I got a hold of you through the Electronic Frontiers Foundation. Gave me your number, and I think you were telling me before we went on that they're the kind of political side, and then you're affiliated with them to help the technological side, to help them get their things done, correct?
Right. See, I first got involved with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I was working on a project called Freenet, which was to make censorship-resistant distribution of information, so you could put up websites and nobody could take them down no matter how hard they tried. And they called me up because they thought that we would probably get sued by the Recording Industry Association of America, because those are the people that sue everybody, you know. And the Scientologists, also very litigious people.
Hey, the only copyrighted religion.
And so they called me up, and they were very nice. They said they might defend us. And so I got with them. I like them. We hang out a lot. But the thing is that they are purely political. They lobby. They defend people. They don't produce any technology. And so our niche is that we want to produce technology which will kind of push the definition of these ambiguous laws, challenge the laws, and then we'll get sued. Or, you know, there'll be some kind of court case against us, and then the EFF can come defend our technology, and then they can make precedents as to what's good and bad, because somebody has to make the technology so that it can be there can be a court case about it.
And really, internet privacy is becoming a really big deal in the news lately. There's been a lot about where police can break into your house and put taps on your keyboard or download your hard drive and then not even tell you that they did it until 6 months later. They can. They have this thing called Carnivore, I guess, that devours all the emails and the websites and searches them all for keywords. Do you know about that? How does that work?
Yeah, Carnivore. It's been in the news because of the fact that in order to get it to work, the government needs to install this box in all the different internet service providers that will, when your email comes through the internet service provider, it goes, you know, through the box and it checks it. And some internet service providers refuse to do it. For instance, Speakeasy is a good internet service provider that you can get. That their policy is always, we're not going to do anything to screw you. That's where they make, because they're more expensive, so that's their policy. They're like, we're going to let you do everything. We're not going to try to screw you over. Whereas most places like AOL, oh, sure. I'm sure that they have a Carnivore box. So the only reason you've heard of it at all is because some of the ISPs were all like, no, we're not going to do it, and then they told people about it. But probably...
So the government couldn't force them to accept the box?
Well... I guess they can't. I mean, I think that they probably could if they tried hard enough. But currently, some people definitely were like, no, we're not going to do it. I guess it's the way they went about it. They'd have to pass some laws that mandate it.
If you look and at forgive China, my ignorance of the internet here, but if I have a good ISP that refuses to take the Echelon box decoder ring thing that they have there, but then I go from that ISP and I start searching around the web and I go to different websites... If their ISP has an Echelon box, then I'm not any more protected, right?
That's right, that's right. If you send email to somebody who has an ISP with Carnivore, then your email is still going to be filtered. I want to bring up China. The entire country of China is behind a massive firewall, which filters and checks all the internet traffic that goes between China and a different country.
That firewall is called communism.
So anything you send to China or anything China sends out to anywhere else, it's all watched, it's all filtered. And in fact, they block lots and lots of websites. They block, you know, CNN.com. They block, you know, all kinds of just news websites and sort of websites that you think, well, you know, people should be able to read that. It's not a big deal.
So if you're in China, you can't get on the internet without going through the central government first.
That's right. It's totally impossible. Well, it would be totally possible, except, you know, that's one of the other projects that we're working on with other people, is making it so that people in China can circumvent the censorship and be able to look at whatever they want and not have the Chinese government look at what they're doing. But that's kind of the worst-case scenario for America, is America could do that, where they could look at everything that's going between America and any other country.
Well, and presumably their Carnivore is eating... I don't know what percentage, a majority of all the electronic traffic on Earth, and filtering it for keywords, right?
Yeah, it's probably, most stuff's probably going through Carnivore. And there's a way to get around it, which is that you can encrypt your email. And if you encrypt your email, then it's unreadable unless somebody actually breaks into your computer and gets your encryption key. The problem is that software for encrypting email, a lot of people can't really figure it out. It's kind of technical. It's not super technical, but it's technical enough that a lot of people just, they don't want to deal with it. It's kind of confusing.
If I want to encrypt my email to you, how do you know the code to decrypt it on your end?
Well, that's a good question.
Do I have to, like, meet you at the park and hand you the code first, and then we can do it?
That's exactly what it is. You need to exchange what's called a public key. You need to exchange that in some kind of safe way where you know you're getting the right one. So you can do it in person, you can do it over the phone, anything where somebody can't intercept it and change it. Like, for instance, if you email it to them, they could intercept your email, and they could, like, send a fake email. It's like, oh, no, this is my key. And then you're encrypting it with something they know, and then, you know, they can read it. So,
sure. Wow, yeah, it sure is a brave new world.
Yeah.
I wonder sometimes if maybe the only reason they let us all have PCs and let us invent our little ways of doing our own thing, like, for example, putting these interviews on the internet, I wonder if that's just kind of to pacify us and help us believe that this technology is for us and not for them. After all, it's state power that has the massive underground rooms full of supercomputers that crunch all these databases and follow us around everywhere we go?
Yeah, I think that the main thing driving technology not being limited is commerce. Like, that's why encryption's still legal in China, is because the main use for encryption on the web is encrypting your credit card numbers so that you can buy stuff from websites. So you could make encryption illegal in China, and it would be a lot harder to circumvent their censorship. It's still legal. And I think that's, you know, I think why technology isn't regulated in the U.S. is because internet, big commerce boom, you know, for a while. It's, you know, it's really, it's been...
And will be again.
Yeah, yeah, certainly. I think that commerce and the internet are very much intertwined in the future. So as long as there's a commercial reason to have technology, I think that it'll probably be allowed, generally.
If I send an email to you and I encrypt it, isn't that just going to raise a flag on their computer, hey, here's an encrypted email, and then set them even double to work trying to decrypt it?
It will certainly probably flag it. I see that's a good possibility.
Unless everybody just starts encrypting all their emails
right.
all the time, and
right.
then we just screw them that
yes.
much harder.
There is a lot of encrypted traffic going around these days because people are getting more paranoid. If you want to keep... businesses especially, you know, if you want to keep hackers from getting into your stuff and if you want to keep people from reading your stuff, then you need to encrypt stuff. And so a lot of web traffic's encrypted these days for commercial reasons, and email not so much encrypted, but a little bit of it is. But even if they flag you and they say, okay, this person's sending encrypted email, it would be a lot of work to break through the encryption. That's the beauty of encryption, is even if they have the encrypted message, it's going to be a lot of work to break it. But they can always come into your house and get into your computer and get your key, and then they can read all your email right there. And
yeah, all they have to do is wait for you to go to your job in the morning.
Yeah, that's right. And recently, with post 9/11 legislation, it's getting a lot easier to do searches without going through a lot of court hassle.
Yeah, hassle, I think, is what they call that.
Yeah.
Those darn loopholes.
Yeah.
That require a judicial check. So, well, let me ask you about this. You talk about commercial transactions on the internet and more business being done over electronic wires. What do you think about cashlessness and moving all the way to a society where all commercial transactions are taking place through electronic databases instead of passing along fake paper money that's at least anonymous, as fake as it is?
Well, I kind of like the idea, actually. I like having everything electronic because it's very convenient for many reasons. And the thing about electronic cash is that you can do anonymous electronic cash, and it's a really, you know, exciting area of research, is anonymous electronic cash. The electronic cash you hear about generally isn't anonymous because it's pushed by people like Visa and MasterCard, who are probably the people that if electronic cash comes out, it's probably going to be them pushing it because they have a lot of money, you know, and a lot of stuff invested in that kind of area. But anonymous cash, you could do it. There are so-called money laundering systems for cash that will get rid of all traces. And, you know, that's an area that we work on, you know, in my, you know, little group of peer-to-peer and anonymity hackers.
Yeah, that's something that's actually worried me for quite a while, that some sort of particular economic catastrophe or something like that could be used as an excuse to get rid of all paper or otherwise anonymous money and force everybody to have, you know, like you're saying, not the anonymous kind, but the MasterCard kind that's kind of your ID and your wallet all rolled into one.
I assure you that when that day comes, that we will have a cash anonymizing system out, and you'll be able to use it, because that's what we do.
Okay, I won't have to just go back to the barter system and trade two chickens for some new wheels for my skateboard.
No, we'll definitely have it all worked out.
All right, let's see what I should ask you now. How about the cameras on the roads? And the, in fact, I have an article here from July 4th. Funny how, I don't know, maybe just pure coincidence. Maybe they saved this article up because they really wanted to put it in there on the 4th of July, Independence Day. I'm not sure. But this is about a new Pentagon system that would track and analyze every vehicle in cities. It says here their plan is, this is from the Austin American Statesman, page A33 from July the 4th. They talk about how they want to be able to go into a city and within 12 hours put up hundreds of cameras and then use the software in their computers to analyze and track every car. And within, they say here, within a day, they should be able to identify, quote, what is normal behavior and what is not, and discover links between places, subjects, and times of activity. And I wonder, you know, this whole thing about, well, they can keep inventing new technology to screw us even more and more, and we're just going to keep inventing new technology to try to get out from under it. How the hell are we going to get out from under that?
Well, yes, increasing amounts of surveillance are, I think, unavoidable. I mean, perhaps there's a political solution to that, but in terms of technologically, I think that we're going to be seeing more surveillance everywhere. And I'm trying to keep positive on the situation, which is that while increased surveillance is certainly scary, it does create some nice opportunities for the co-optation of the surveillance network for non-official purposes, which I think you have to look at it as the people are going to be surveilled more and more in the future, but that we should just look at that as an opportunity to also surveil the authorities as well. I mean, if the cameras are on the roads, you know, the people that put the cameras on the roads, they're going to be on the roads, you know. If everybody's equally surveilled, then it all balances out.
Okay, I guess I could see that. If we have access to their surveillance over us, and assuming that we can use it to surveil
Well,
them.
They're not going to give you access. I'm not saying that there's going to be like a public website where you can go to look at all of the cameras, but I think that access will be made available once it becomes sufficiently widespread that it would be worth it to go through the trouble.
And this is a message to all you would-be totalitarians out there. The more you tighten your grip, the more regular people decide that, hey, you know, that system ain't right. I don't really care, you know, what TV says over and over again. I can see that this isn't right, and I'm going to set about to undermine it in whatever way I can. And you get people like Brandon Wiley here, who doesn't seem like a very political hotbed of anger and vile like myself, but who still is doing everything he can to get out from under this system, and doing everything he can to help us get out from under it too. And I hope that you're right. I appreciate your optimistic point of view on the kind of individualist's ability to help himself and other people use the system of control for, if we can't destroy it, at least try to use it against them.
Well, and the great thing about software specifically is this encapsulation of skill. You only need one guy who knows how to turn everything around, and they just package it up, and they just ship it on the internet. Everyone downloads it. Once one guy figures out how to watch all the cameras, you know, like 3 hours later, everyone on the internet's going to have the software. They're going to be looking at all the cameras. That's the beautiful thing about software.
In the 1990s, I guess I haven't really heard as much about this since September 11th, but in the 1990s, when there was so much rhetoric about it's not a matter of if, but when the terrorists strike, a big focus of the attention was on the electronic infrastructure and the ability of terrorists to come in and, in the words of our elite, at least shut down the internet and paralyze all of our commerce. I really don't understand the internet's complexity enough to really be able to say one way or another whether, I mean, I guess it seems like that wouldn't be possible if we're talking about so many millions of different computers all connected to each other, but is there a way that terrorists or state power of some kind could come in and really just shut down the internet for everybody?
Yeah, shutting down the internet, I think, is actually not all that hard.
Really?
Yeah. In the group of researchers that I, you know, hang out with, it seems like shutting down the internet isn't that hard. The problem is that nobody really wants to do it, and that if you did do it, it would be back up in a couple of days. There's no way to really keep it down. But if you look at the traffic that's been generated by internet viruses lately, it really clogs things up. And these are benign viruses. These are viruses that were made just to see if they could propagate, and just the speed at which they propagate and the amount of, you know, resources they use in their propagation, the internet slowed down, you know, significantly. So, and they got enough penetration that if they, you know, just said, okay, whatever computer I'm on, crash it, they would crash a significant portion of it. Now, the military, you know, they have their own separate internet, which is connected but separate, and it would probably be safe. But the commercial and consumer internet would be, you know, pretty much down. But the thing is, you know, it goes down, and then you just reboot all the systems, clean them out, and it comes right back up again. The only real way to really destroy the internet is, you know, to blow up the physical infrastructure, because it all goes through a few major choke points owned by, like, Sprint and, you know, MCI and AT&T. They have these big data centers, which are just these nerves where everything goes in, and it is rooted through there. And the universities, like MIT, that's, if you blew up MIT, that would be like the whole East Coast right there. So much traffic goes through MIT, because that they kind of invented the internet. But in terms of, you know, software, it's easy, but it's not, you know, it's ephemeral. It goes, the effects go away in a couple days.
But really, the hardware is vulnerable at few points that really are the centers of all the other kind of things.
That's right.
See, exactly. My imagination didn't have it like that, with a few choke points. I sort of imagine everything pretty much all equally interlinked throughout.
Right. I wish that was the case. That's a much more, you know, egalitarian sort of setup. But it really goes through all these choke points. Now, the thing is, if you were to disrupt those points, that wouldn't actually disrupt network communication within the cities, you know, within specific places. It's just the cities are linked, you know, together. Like, for instance, like, how do we get across that great desert, you know, of Nevada and New Mexico and Phoenix? There's, like, you know, a couple of cables, but you cut them and then, you know, like, the whole, you know, that our link between us and them is gone. But everything, you know, here is still fine. In fact, there's a lot of internet infrastructure in cities run by individuals now that's not even under the control of the phone companies with the wireless internet. Like, if you go to New York or Seattle or San Francisco, it doesn't matter. You can destroy the entire phone company and cable company, and everybody in San Francisco is still going to be talking because they have the wireless infrastructure that people just popped up just for fun. So,
and really, if that's the future, is taking the whole internet wireless, then, well, they don't still need to check back with the major wireless phone company or whatever, is it?
No, they're routing it all? They don't go through the cellular companies. It's all through boxes that people put on phone booths and on the top of buildings, and they just put on a solar panel and just strap them on, and then they're just, you know, there, and that's how it works. It doesn't use cellular.
Kick ass.
Yeah.
The mind of an individual worming its way out from under the boot of the total state, making it possible. And yeah, you know, it's sort of the same thing with electricity. You know, they got us all hooked to this big grid where if they decide to blow up the grid here, here, and here, and they being whoever, you know, whether foreign enemies or domestic ones, that, you know, they could really cripple us. Where, I mean, if you think about it, the people of the United States and all our different states and counties and whatever and private industry, we surely have the capability to have 1,000 different electric grids that aren't dependent on each other, and yet somehow we insist on, perhaps just for so-called efficiency purposes, we insist on having everything all interconnected, where if there's a single big crisis in any center, that it can travel all around the whole place.
And this is exactly what we're talking about decentralization with the Foundation for Decentralization Research. This is the whole idea, is instead of being in this hierarchical structure where we're dependent on this central point of failure, everybody can do their own thing, and it just all kind of works together, you know, through the standards that we're setting. It all works together into this big mesh, so that you disrupt any part of it, everything else still works.
Did you see that stupid Steven Spielberg movie, Minority Report?
Yeah.
Where everywhere the citizen goes, the cameras everywhere take pictures of your eyeballs and identify you?
Yes.
Is there going to be any way around that besides having my eyeballs pulled out and replaced?
Well, the thing that they're actually rolling out is called RFID, and it doesn't use the retinal scanning idea. It uses tiny, I mean really tiny, almost impossible to see transmitters. And in fact, some clothing line, I forgot who it was thinking about coming out with a line of clothing with RFID tags. Now, the idea originally, like the thing that they're pitching it as, is that RFID tags will let you keep inventory better. Like if something is missing, if something's stolen or, you know, doesn't arrive or something, you'll know because you just run this scanner through the whole store. It scans all the tags and all of the little items, and then, you know, you know which ones you have.
Wait, is this something different than if I buy something and I walk through the metal detector deal at the front of the HEB and it goes off? This
yeah.
Is something different than that?
Yeah, this is different because the thing here is that every single RFID tag is individual. See, those things you're talking about, that's they disable them. It's just like a, either I'm here or I'm not here. And these, they have an individual serial number. And the thing which is useful here is that you can track individual products. You can't just say, is this stolen or is it not stolen? You can say, okay, which product is this? So, for instance,
but of course, if you buy a shirt at Walmart, then they have the record because you're stupid and you use your MasterCard. They have the record of who bought the shirt.
Right.
And then everywhere you go wearing that shirt, it's broadcasting this signal out.
That's
and they know who's wearing that shirt and everywhere you go.
And actually, right now, this is true, too. This is not some kind of paranoid delusion. This is absolutely true. You can get your pets have a surgically implanted RFID tag. You can do
that. Oh, sure. They've had that for years and years. Yeah. I remember they first came out with the Tyrus transponder by Texas Instruments back in the early 1990s.
Right.
They used them in the shoes of the runners in the Olympic Games to judge who won the race was by the transponder in their shoe.
Exactly. So the RFID thing, a lot of people think it's just kind of paranoia that's not really coming out, but it is. Walmart was about to roll out RFID and all their products. They didn't. Like, there was, you know, people like, oh, don't do that. We don't like it. And they didn't do it.
So, wait. Let's not go too fast past that point.
Sure.
Walmart was going to do it.
Yeah.
And a bunch of people said hell no, and
that's
then they decided not to.
That's right.
Okay. So, that, to me, that's the most important point of this whole discussion.
Oh, certainly.
Is that when the people are right about something and they say it loudly enough, they get what they want, even from a massive multinational corporation like Walmart, they do exactly what they're told because they make all their money off of us.
Yeah, Walmart.
And we're in the driver's seat if we demand to be.
That was a big win, you know, Walmart, because that's everywhere. Once Walmart rolls out something, it's everywhere. So that was a big win. I think that eventually somebody is going to roll it out, and so the question is, what happens then? You know, if people actually didn't buy the products, then that would be pretty much the death of RFID. But
pardon me if I'm being too cynical, but couldn't they just say, well, this whole microchip in everybody's clothes and everything isn't going to fly? And couldn't they just take pictures of our face and have the chip instead of on us implanted in our body or in our clothes? Couldn't they just have the chip in their computer and all they need is just take a picture of our face or the way we walk and that's our chip, that's our code number?
They have the face recognition software in airports now. They have that, and it's pretty good from what I've seen. I think that the
works
thing,
well.
Yeah. I'm sorry. That's what I meant. Yeah, it works pretty well.
Okay. Just making sure.
And so I think the thing about face recognition is that it requires a lot more infrastructure to get it to work. With the RFID, you know, you got the tag, and then anywhere you go, you just get close enough to them with the thing and with a little transponder, and it'll do it.
So this is sort of just like if you go to mobile and they have that Easy Pass keychain where you just wave it near the pump. And same technology.
But a much bigger range. You know, so you can kind of just sweep. You know, they just get in a van and sweep around, and it'll tell you when it hits the thing. But I don't know. As far as like tracking people, cell phones. You know, everybody knows they track you with your cell phone, but nobody seems to care, and there's not any way around that.
Well, and it was a matter of just triangulating you, but now they're actually installing GPS.
That's right.
In the phones.
That's right. Exactly. So, and everybody wants GPS phones. They don't even think of them as being a privacy problem. They just think, you know, GPS phones. It'll be great. I can know where I am, and everyone else knows where you are too. And you know, that sort of thing. And I think that's pretty scary. But on the other hand, as a technologist, I don't really feel like there's anything I can do politically to stop that. So we're just going to look into seeing what we can do technologically. But I'm not saying that the political action is necessary. Some people need to do that, and the EFF, that's what they do. That's their job.
Right. How much would these RFIDs add to the cost of the product? I mean, you're talking about they're terribly small. How much do they cost?
RFIDs are ridiculously cheap. Ridiculously. Like, you don't buy one for a penny. You buy several for a penny. I don't know exactly how many. And they're getting much cheaper. The way that they produce them is, like, they don't manufacture them individually. They have, like, this big solution with this big grid, and then they just kind of, like, shake it up, and then the RFID is kind of crystallized as, like, hundreds of thousands of them simultaneously. And I saw the guy that produces RFID, one of the manufacturers that's producing them with this new super fast process. I was talking to them, was like, you know, how long until the RFIDs really get rolled out? And he said that they've had ads for millions of them, and that the problem is that they can't quite meet the demand yet. So it's going to take them maybe 2 years to produce like 5 million or whatever. That's a razor company. I think it was BIC. They decided that they wanted to put an RFID in every single one of their razors.
I think I heard Gillette.
Gillette.
Right.
Yes. So Gillette is going to put an RFID in every single one of their razor blades that they sell in like packs of like like 32 or something.
No more of my money for you. I'm going to have to just walk around with a hairy face now. What are the physical consequences of exposure to RF? If I'm wearing a shirt that's full of these little microchips, are they going to give me cancer?
No, the RFIDs are totally passive. They only emit a signal when they're hit by a scanner, which uses the particular radio frequency for that thing. So really, it should be really hard to even find that they're in your clothes at all unless you have an RFID scanner.
Which is really what makes it worse. You're not just going to be able to go dig through your shirt and find it and rip it out.
Absolutely, absolutely not. If you don't know it's there, I doubt you'd be able to find it. They're really tiny.
I was at the dentist's office, and I was reading an article in, I think it was Popular Science. This would have been a couple of years ago, and I think this is what they were talking about. What does RF stand for again? I'm sorry.
Radio frequency.
Oh, okay. I was thinking maybe it was something more complicated than that. And they were talking about putting these little things on everything so that your TV dinner talks to your microwave and your shoes talk to your socks and you're not just, people being interactive with each other through technology, but all of these things talking to each other, your couch talking to your pants as you sit down, and just insanity. And I'm wondering, are you guys going to have a little gadget where I can press a button and it'll send out some kind of little nuke wave that'll destroy all these things within a mile or two of me or something? This is giving me the creeps, man. I don't want to live in a world where my TV dinner's talking to my microwave.
It's funny that you should ask that, because that's one of the questions I asked the fellow that I was talking about RFID is, how do we go around blowing up all the RFID tags?
And please, do tell.
Right, and he did tell me that, yes, you can make a device which is not harmful to people but does fry all the RFID tags. So you could go to Walmart, you could just walk around with it in your backpack, and it would just blow up everything you go buy. Now, this would probably be very illegal, because it would disrupt their inventory system greatly. But of course, if you're just doing it, in your own house, I'm sure that's just fine.
All you techno individualists out there better get to work. It's all coming soon. And again, for anybody just tuning in, I want to restate the point that you brought up there, that Walmart was about to debut this system where they were going to put these RFIDs in all their products, and the outcry forced them to retract that and say, well, I guess we're going to have to work on conditioning you to accept it for a couple of more years before we try again.
Right. And that's happened to everybody that's tried to roll it out so far, except for Gillette. Nobody really seems to care about Gillette. I don't think really people know about that or think about that, but the clothing line, what retracted it, and Walmart retracted it. So
it just goes to show, everybody talks about, well, can't really do anything about it, so why care? Sure, you can do stuff about it. If you and all the other individuals who think like you all call the same congressman on the same day to complain about the same thing, or call the same company during the same week to tell them, well, I'm not shopping with you as long as you're putting RFIDs and everything. I'll go shop at Target instead. So, hey, they back off. It's their job. They're trying to save it.
That's right.
And you're their boss if you'd only take that role.
And also, if you get affiliated, if you join the EFF or if you join the Foundation for Decentralization Research, that's, both what we're both trying to do, both organizations, is to stop them. So any support you can give to either organization is going to, further, human rights and technology.
So if I was to ask you, what do you think America's going to look like, technologically speaking, 10 or 15 years from now?
Right.
What pictures does that conjure up?
Well, what we're kind of our, kind of utopian vision for the future of the Internet is one in which there's kind of a virtual Internet layered on top of the normal Internet, a virtual Internet which is, it's encrypted, it's secure, and it's just, it's just anarchy. Everybody can do whatever they want to do on the Internet, and because of our technical solutions to problems, there's just really no way that anybody can stop them without restructuring the Internet. That's kind of what we're going for. And there's another website you should check out if you like this vision, which is infoanarchy.org, which is the info-anarchist crowd, which kind of share this kind of idea of what the Internet should be like. And that's pretty much where all the people that do this sort of thing, they hang out on the InfoAnarchy IRC channel on the Freenode network. So.
Right on. In fact, I guess it was years ago I was giving my little rant and rave about this new world order and this global police state and how there's barely any hope at all. And a guy said to me, I think you're dead wrong. And I don't think you're wrong about the plan. I just think you're wrong that they have a chance to succeed, because if the future is computers and technology and the internet, and the people who produce all the newest technology, like I think he was using Linux as an example, that it was just made by individualists and anarchists and libertarian software programmers all around the country, just adding it together, doing it all for free, fixing up each other's work and making it a little better, and that if the people who create all the technology are all individualists and care about liberty, then it's going to be really hard for state power to use that technology against us.
Yeah, and also, I mean, if you look at the things that have been popular, that have been adopted lately, like peer-to-peer file sharing with Napster and all that sort of thing, everybody loves that. The people love that. It's very popular. And so the recording industry, specifically, being one of the big enemies of the recording industry of Scientologists, they try to shut it down, and they can't. They haven't been able to. I mean, it's they've been working, and they have money, they have people, they have lawyers, and they haven't been able to do it. Similarly,
and it's all their own fault for charging $15 a CD. Guess what, pal? I'm downloading. What?
Yeah. And, you know, also, a lot of people, you know, they want to get stuff like live tracks. They want to get, like, covers and remixes and, you know, original stuff that you can't buy. I like to listen to a lot of obscure music that you can't really find. And, you know, that's how you get it. You get on the internet because the internet moves, you know, at internet speed. Whereas, you know, stuff here, like, I like to watch a lot of movies from Korea and Japan and that sort of thing. You can get them on the internet. You can't get them in the video store. You know, it doesn't work out. And so I think that as long as, you know, all the people, they want this sort of stuff, it doesn't matter how much they're going to try. Unless, of course, legislation, you know, legislation can really put a damper on things. But in terms of just, you know, individual or entities, you know, corporate entities trying to do things, I don't think they really have a chance.
If they go and put some kind of, well, like, say, for example, I rent a DVD, mm-hmm. and I want to download it into my computer, mm-hmm. the DVD's got a thing on it where it makes it all screwed up, yeah. right, where I can't record it well, but then you guys can just invent something to undo that, right?
Yeah, that was actually a big EFF deal. There's encryption called CSS on DVDs, and this guy, he wrote some software called DCSS. And the reason he wanted to decrypt the DVDs was because he wanted to play them on Linux, and you can't play them on Linux because they won't provide decryption software on Linux because, you know, they don't like Linux. It's kind of this thing. They like Windows, you know, like Microsoft.
Right, they don't like Linux because it was made for free by a bunch of individuals.
Right, and so they don't want to give their decryption software to the Linux people because the Linux people will give it to everyone and everybody will have it. And, you know, they want to keep a stranglehold. And so that's what the lawsuit was about. They sued him. He was in jail for a while. He was arrested. He's not even in America. He's in Sweden, I think. And but it was a big mess. And EFF, you know, they helped out with that. And you know, right now everyone can watch DVDs under Linux. It's not a big deal. And copying DVDs and that sort of thing. It's just they try, but there's just nothing you can do. It's just technically impossible.
Well, and this was the same debate when I was a little kid about VCRs.
Yeah.
And they screamed and yelled that everybody's just going to steal their movies. And, of course, what happened was people still go to the movies because they like it really loud. They like a clear picture with the THX sound. They like to sit there and stuff their face and sit next to a bunch of strangers and all enjoy the movie together and that kind of thing. And so people didn't stop going to the movie theater when VCRs came out. And they still haven't, even though people can download them on their computers.
Yeah. And, you know, the people that I know that download the most music off the internet, buy the most CDs and go to the most shows. It's just you love the stuff, you get the stuff every way you can. That's what it's really about.
And I think the bands have found that out too, right? Go ahead and give it away free and they're going to come and buy the album because they like it.
There was actually a website in Austin called Audio Galaxy, which was probably the coolest file sharing thing ever. It was entirely supported by people that wanted their music on there, paying them to host their music to make sure that everybody could download it at a really fast rate. They had no, like, venture capital. That was
so. So you don't have to wait on my stupid 56K modem to download a song for me. They go ahead and download the song for me and keep it so that you can just come and download it in the blink of an eye at your place.
And they were entirely funded by people paying them to provide the service, but they were shut down by the recording industry because the recording industry said, you're not trying hard enough to keep people from trading, you know, our music on your service. And they were. They had really good blocking. If it was owned by the RIAA, you could not get it. But the thing is, the recording industry wants to shut down independent music distribution. They don't care about piracy. They don't care about copyright.
They care about competition.
Exactly.
They care about you being able to rock your ass off and still listen to the same crap they package on their FM dial.
The reason they shut down the webcasters is because they don't like webcasting. They want radio stations, which they control, which play their music, and only their music, and that's why you hear the same music all the time, is because there's this whole, you know, kickback thing going on. And they admit this. I mean, you know, everybody knows this. You know, Hillary Rosen, the head of the RIA, she left, but when she was, I mean, you know, she admitted that these things are true. That and that's what we're trying to get back to, is we're trying to get with the Foundation for Decentralization Research, we're trying to help the independent people put up their stuff and forget about the radio. Let's just assume radio is dead, you know. So, you know, that's their plan. Have the independent people be able to do, just say whatever they want, get their music out there, and let people be able to get it, you know. Because right now, if you know, you're the reason that Audio Galaxy is so successful is because if you're a band and you put your stuff on your website, if you get at all popular, then you're going to start paying crazy bandwidth bills from people downloading your music. Music's big, you know. If you've got like a little dinky, you know, like web hosting, it's going to get expensive really fast. And you know, with the software that we're producing, it's practically free. Like you don't need any money to put your stuff up there. So,
kick ass. I really am excited about this kind of thing. I like the idea of being able to get on the internet and read, you know, some guy in Zimbabwe or China or whatever's point of view on whatever it is.
Yeah.
And I really like, even though I'm not particularly technically minded myself, I really like the idea of the people who are going ahead and doing their own thing. And, you know, it really troubles me that, you know, one of the most popular websites on the internet is CNN.com or something.
Right.
Like, we don't get enough of that crap on TV. We go turn on our internet and then we go to their website.
Right.
There's a million news sites on the internet.
That's right.
That are got 100 times the information that you could ever find on CNN.com. And I think, really, it's just a matter of time, because if you go to search for a news story on CNN.com and they don't seem to have it, and you just go type it in your Google, boy, you're going to stumble across all kinds of stuff that you had no idea about.
Yeah, that's, I think, actually our next project after we finish with the radio stuff. We get some, you know, sites up and running and self-sufficient. Our next thing is probably going to be news dissemination, because news, it takes a lot less bandwidth, you know, to run a news site. It's just, you know, it's text, maybe some pictures. But especially if you start getting popular, you start getting a lot of hits. Like, especially happened during 9/11 when all of the big major news sites shut down. Like, they just couldn't handle the load. Then more traffic started going to the smaller sites. And the smaller sites were totally unprepared for the amount of traffic that they got. And, you know, that happens sometimes. Like, one story that people really like can totally just shut you down. So we're working on a decentralized news propagation architecture so that you can get your news out and it's cheap and you don't have to worry about it not being available, like if you have too much load. So also combining with our radio stuff, being able having small news sites, be able to do like video and audio, you know, sorts of things. I'm working on a system for people to go cover events, protests and that sort of thing, and be able to, you know, get video clips and then be able to transmit them to people. That's another one of our projects.
Excellent. Sounds like you guys are doing a really great job. And I just got to say, I love the name, even if I had no idea that you were even talking about technology. Anything called the Foundation for Decentralization Research, I can't think of a single thing that's better centralized,
yeah.
Much less the
exactly.
Internet.
Exactly. Yeah. So everybody's interested in that, they should go to decentralized.org and, you know, and check us out. Because, you know, the more people know about us, the more we can get, you know, the stuff out there. Because we just want to help people. We're a nonprofit. We're just there for the good of the people, public good.
Kick-ass internet anarchy. All right, give us a few more websites again, because you mentioned a few throughout this thing.
Okay, right. There's decentralized.org. That's us. There's EFF.org. You know, that's the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the legal branch of saving privacy on the internet. Infoanarchy.org is a good place if you want to go learn about, you know, anarchy through technology. Think if there's anything else good. That's probably... Oh, and the IRC channel, Internet Relay Chat. That's irc.freenode.net on the Info Anarchy channel. That's where you can go if you want to meet people that are into this sort of thing. They're all right there. I'm right there. You can see me. My name is Blanu, B-L-A-N-U.
All right, everybody. This has been the Weekend Interview Show. Thank you so much for coming on the air. Brandon Wiley, president of the Foundation for Decentralization Research.